It had been my prayer that if God wanted me to do anything about the Alcas, that he would make that possible, little imagining that it would ever happen.
Jim Elliott and four other missionaries were seeking to reach out to a fierce Ecuadorian tribe known as the Alcas when those same Indians turned on them. The shocking news of the deadly attack spread around the world. On Gateway to Joy, Elizabeth Elliott shares with you the lessons learned through that and many other events in her remarkable journey. Thanks for joining us for Gateway to Joy. Here's Elizabeth Elliott.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says, and underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend Elizabeth Elliott, talking with you this time about two Stone Age women. In my last talk, I told you how, in the providence of God, I was able to contact two Alca women, members of the tribe that had killed my husband and four other American missionaries in 1956. It had been my prayer that if God wanted me to do anything about the Alcas, that he would make that possible, little imagining that it would ever happen or how it could possibly happen. These two women had come out voluntarily to Quechua territory. I had been notified by two Quechua men who led me to where they were. But then, because of a killing that took place while we were there, when Alcas came out and killed one of the Quechua men, the entire village was evacuated. And so I went back to my own station, working with the Quechua Indians in another area of the jungle, a place called Shandia. And I took with me my daughter Valerie, and Mintaka and Mancamo, the two Alca women. You can imagine the sensation that two Alca women would cause in a Quechua village. I heard one of the Indian girls say, "Why, they're just like us. They've got arms and legs. Do they eat, senora? Do they sleep?" And then one boy said, "Why, they've only got two legs. I just counted them." He said, "I thought they'd have four or five legs, but I just counted them. They've only got two." And then I don't know how many times people said to me, "Do they speak?" "Oh, they don't speak. They just make noises, don't they?" Well, of course, a language that sounds like this, I can understand why people thought it doesn't really sound like a language. It's just noises. But it was a language. Mintaka, Mancamo, Valerie, and I went to live not in the fancy house that Jim had built for us, because I didn't really think that Alca women would be comfortable in a cement-floored house with wooden walls and an aluminum roof. We went to live in the house of a man called Kua. He was a Quechua Indian. He had a fairly large house, and several of his children were friends of mine. They said, "Come and live with us if you want to." And I said, "Will you let Mintaka and Mancamo live in your house too?" And they said, "Fine." And so we established ourselves. They added a small addition to the house where I could put my desk and my little stove and where Valerie could sleep. And we moved in. Mintaka and Mancamo began to participate in the work of the plantation and the general housework, as any Quechua woman would do. And I began the most important job, which was trying to learn the Alca language. I had a small tape recorder. This was back in the early days of tape recorders. It was a pretty crude one compared to the ones that you can buy nowadays, but it served the purpose. And I got Mintaka and Mancamo to talk into the microphone, and then I sent the tapes to the United States to Rachel Saint. Rachel had been studying the Alca language with a young woman by the name of Dayuma. Dayuma had left the Alca tribe many years before, but had been living as a servant or a slave on a nearby hacienda. Rachel had contacted her there and was now on a visit to the States with Dayuma. So I sent these tapes of Mintaka and Mancamo's talking to Rachel with the hope that Rachel and Dayuma together would be able to transcribe what they were saying. I was dying to know what in the world these women were saying to me. They had no comprehension of the fact that I didn't understand their language. Even though it was very obvious to them that I didn't speak their language, somehow it didn't get through to them that I could not understand them. And so they talked a blue streak. I finally learned the word I don't understand, which is "inyinamindawa." And you can be sure I used that phrase very often. "Inyinamindawa." But they didn't believe me. They thought I was pulling their leg when I said I don't understand. They worked, and they swam, and they bathed, and they helped in the house, and they played with Valerie, and they talked, and they talked. And every minute that I could possibly be there, I was there with my notebook and pen, trying to write down anything I heard them say. It's wonderful the way a baby learns a language. He doesn't have to write things down in notebooks. He remembers what he hears. He can repeat it, and he understands what it means. It is a mysterious and almost miraculous process. But unfortunately, when you get to be an adult, you don't have that ability. And so I went charging around with my notebook and pen, frantically trying to hear what they said and get it down on paper. One day, Mankama woke up with her jaw badly swollen. She was crying. I could see that she had a toothache. She was holding a glowing stick next to her cheek, the jungle substitute for a hot water bottle. And so we had to make a flight out to the dentist. That was an experience. Was she afraid? She was completely submissive to me when I said, "Follow me," and we went to the airstrip and got on the airplane. When we got off the plane, she followed me into the dentist office, sat down in the chair with the greatest meekness, and submitted to having her tooth pulled. It scared the life out of her and Mintaka when a truck came lurching and roaring down the road. That was the first time they'd ever seen that, because in the station where we had been living, there was only an airstrip. There were no roads. And when Mintaka saw this truck lurching down the road, she grabbed Valerie and headed for the ditch, sure that we were all doomed. Then I think one of the things that got the most expressions of surprise out of them was the braying of a donkey nearby. They had never seen animals that were domesticated before, and yet even at that they were not really afraid. When they saw a man on horseback, I thought they would die laughing. That was just too much. They almost had hysterics. We went back to Shandia after the tooth had been taken care of, and I was doing my best to learn their language. I could say just a few words, a few phrases, say it again, "What's he doing? What is this?" And as a man began weaving a roof, then they gave me the phrase, "The man is weaving the roof." Very, very gradually, very slowly, they began to catch on to what I was trying to do. One day, I showed them the basket in which the five men before they were killed had received a parrot, a live parrot that had been given to them by the bucket drop method. When Nate was flying the plane, lowering a bucket on a line from the airplane, the Alcas on the ground had actually grabbed the basket and had put in it a live parrot, which arrived safe and sound, complete with a half-eaten banana. When Mankamo saw the basket, she laughed and said to me, "I made it." She gestured in such a way that I was able to understand that she was saying, "I made it." So I wrote that down. Then there was a piece of string tied to the basket, and she said, "Akawo made that." Then Mintaka came along and said, "The parrot belonged to Minkayi." Well, I didn't know Minkayi, but I wrote down Minkayi's name, thinking maybe someday I'll meet him. Then they told me, by gestures and by words, how a man named Nampa, thinking that perhaps he could get a ride, had tied himself to the cord that was lowered from the airplane. Fortunately, Nate had thought of such an eventuality and had arranged a brake cord so that if anything too heavy was tied to it, it would automatically break. And so Nampa was very disappointed he didn't get his ride through space when he tied himself to the cord. Then the time came when I took Mintaka and Mankamo to Guayaquil, the largest city in Ecuador, the port city. We took a bus. We went up into cold weather in the mountains, the Andes. We had provided them with wool clothing, which they didn't understand at all at the beginning, and then they began to realize the need for them. We took ferries and trains. I showed them the tall buildings and the marketplace. Nothing impressed them until I took them to the place where the bananas were stacked up for export. there were about 3 blocks worth of bananas stacked up, ready to go on the barges out to the ships that were waiting at the mouth of the river. They looked at me in absolute disbelief, and Mancamo said, "Who would cut all those bananas for just one day?" Then someone had taken movie footage when the 5 men had had a friendly contact with the Alcas. This footage had been flown back to Arahuno before the men were killed, so I arranged to have the Alca women see that movie footage. This, I was convinced, would certainly blow their minds. No, there were no signs of amazement, but they did giggle when they saw themselves on the screen. They giggled when they saw the people that they knew. But would you believe Mintaka got bored before the film was over and left early? There's no fathoming the so-called primitive mind. Then, as we traveled high in the Andes, they kept giving me one word over and over again. I would point to snow caps, rabbits, goats, sheep, trucks, and I kept getting the word Kiimimba, Kiimimba. So I wrote down Kiimimba dutifully with snow caps, rabbits, goats after it. Finally, my stupidity dawned on me. What they were saying to me was, "Who knows what it is?" They'd never seen a snow cap or a rabbit or a goat or a sheep or a truck. My prayer one morning for a special sign of help came when Mintaka made plain to me that she was asking me to go back with them when they went home. I was able to understand that much. And I was able to say to her, "Will they spear me?" And she said, "Geek Gadi," that's the name they had made up for me, "Geek Gadi, your husband was a man. They speared him because they were afraid."
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliot, author of over 20 books, including Discipline, The Glad Surrender, and No Graven Image. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliot. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.